Well, I've been asked to speak on the Middle East, which is actually a vast subject, both geographically and historically, because it's a huge area with so many different situations within it, such as the conflict in Israel-Palestine, the situation in Lebanon, the Iraq war, the situation in Iran, the situation in Egypt, the situation in Saudi Arabia and other states. Now, because of that, obviously I can't give a detailed outline of each one of these. I mean, you could have just one discussion just on Israel-Palestine or just on the Iraq war. Just to remind comments of something that Trotsky once referred to when he was talking about U.S. imperialism. He said that U.S. imperialism has dynamite built, but the dynamite of the colonial revolution built into its foundations. And I think we see that now with what's happening with the Iraq war and how a situation so far away from the United States is dramatically affecting the whole of the situation in the United States itself. It's having a radicalizing process and a polarization of U.S. society. And it's not just the Iraq war, obviously. I mean, if you think about the massive movement of Latino immigrants in the United States, you see how the dynamite of the Latin American Revolution is built into the foundations of U.S. imperialism. It's a superpower that dominates the planet, and because of that, also brings home all the contradictions of the world within it. And I'll refer to that later on in my lead-off. But because of the vastness of the subject, unfortunately, some of the things I say about some of the countries have to be a little bit schematic and brief. The idea is to give an outline. Now, of course, the center of attention is Iraq, with the Iraq war that's been going on the last few years. And if you want to say what the Iraq war is about, one of the reasons, obviously, is oil. Iraq has a huge reserve of oil. And it's not just Iraq, it's the countries around it, which is, you know, it's the biggest concentration of oil if you put all these countries together, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, etc. But it's not just about the oil in Iraq, it's about the whole region. There's a strategic reason. Now, many years ago, in the discussions in the organization, after the Vietnam War, we drew the conclusion that the Americans had burnt their fingers in the Vietnam War, and would be very wary of launching another Vietnam or another invasion of a former colonial country. But we made one exception. We thought that they might invade Saudi Arabia. The reason being the oil, obviously. Not all of Saudi Arabia, just a part of it, so the strip where down one side where most of the oil fields are. Because it's of such importance to capitalism. You consider that the whole system without oil would just come to a grinding halt, and all the social upheaval that would embody. The reason they invaded Iraq is they've been planning it for some years, the lobby around Bush. The idea was to have a base in the Middle East from which they could deal with instability in other countries around Iraq. In particular, they had the idea that Saudi Arabia would be easily invaded from Iraq, and also they thought create a strong base against Iran, because they're in conflict with Iran. Remember, by the way, that in the past America supported Iraq and supported Saddam Hussein against Iran. They supported them in the war and armed them. The jokes I've seen, even when I go and fix my scooter, there's jokes about up on the wall about I think it was his Bush and Rumsfeld saying, "We know they've got weapons of mass destruction. We got the receipts." Because they sold the bloody things to them in the past to fight Iran, of course. And then they turned on them. It's all backfiring now, of course, as the comrades can see, and I'll go into that a little bit later on. But just another center of attention in the Middle East, of course, is the Israel-Palestine conflict. Now, there's lots of articles on our website on this, on the historical development of Israel. But just to say briefly, Israel obviously was built out of the Jewish question. It's a separate issue, we can't go into the details of it, but because of the historical role the Jews played in Western society, they they became victims of pogroms in different periods, and in particular, in Tsarist Russia in the 1880s, there were pogroms in which many Jews were killed. They became the scapegoat, the classic minority that you blame for all the ills of society. And the Zionism, with the idea of creating a homeland in Palestine for the Jews, i.e. going back to Israel, which was the promised land, which was a very small minority point of view amongst Jews, started to gain a hearing amongst the Jews, particularly after these pogroms, and especially in the 1930s with the way the Jews were treated under Nazi Germany. It was such a traumatic experience that the idea of building a safe homeland for the Jews gained a massive hearing amongst the Jews. Although, if you read the history, you'll see that most Jews wanted to go to places like the United States. Their idea of escaping was to go there, logically. It's a much better place to live than to be surrounded by enemy Arab states who want to destroy you. And the Zionists actually consciously developed a policy. For instance, there was the famous case where, it's all on our website in the section on Israel-Palestine, a boat full of Jews fleeing from Nazi-occupied Europe, from Romania, but wasn't allowed to dock and was held out at sea outside Turkey, and eventually it was bombed and all the Jews on board were killed. And the so-called West, who were defending the poor Jews, did nothing to defend these people. The idea that the Brits had there was that if you let too many out, they'll all want to come into their mandate, which was Israel-Palestine. But the policies of the right-wing Zionists was force the Jews to go to Palestine, create a situation where they would go there in order to create this state. Now, you see the way the imperialists have treated the Jews and the Palestinians over all these years. In 1916, there was the famous Sykes-Picot Agreement, which promised Palestine to the Arabs, i.e. it would be for the Palestinians, and it would be for the formation of a Palestinian state. 1 year later, there was the famous Balfour Letter, which said that they would promote a national home for the Jews in Palestine. So British imperialism actually promised a homeland to both the Jews and the Palestinians in Palestine. And the game they were playing was to play one off against the other, like they did in Northern Ireland. Create a situation where you have a division in the population, and the famous tactic of divide and rule, and so you can control them from outside. In fact, the policies of British imperialism in Israel, in Palestine, were not to form a Jewish state. There's a bit of a myth, you know, that imperialism fully backed the creation of Israel. British imperialism didn't. British imperialism had the idea of creating a divided state, so that when they left, because they were being forced out, like they had to leave many of their colonies, they could leave a divided population and therefore control it from outside, a little bit like, as I said, Northern Ireland. The problem was that there was a massive influx of Jews, more and more, and at the end of the Second World War, US imperialism had a different position to British imperialism, and it was actually a maneuver against British imperialism on the part of US imperialism to back the formation of Israel. And by the way, the USSR also backed the formation of Israel and then later pretended that they supported the Palestinians. And the reasons both the USSR and the USA backed the creation of Israel was as a blow against British imperialism. They were carving out the world after the Second World War, and our friends across the Atlantic, as you know, the Blair there had his friendly relationship with the Americans, and there's this myth about how friendly they are. America was a rising imperialist power, and Britain was a declining imperialist power at the end of the Second World War, and in this conflict, America just sort of gave the Brits the elbow out of the Middle East, and in so doing backed the creation of Israel. And the idea was, and from the point of view of US imperialism, was to create an outpost of their interests in the Middle East. Because they couldn't trust any of the Arab regimes, because they were classic colonies struggling against imperialism, Israel became a kind of outpost of the West in the Middle East, and to this day, it's the only real, sure, 100% ally of Western imperialism in the region. The idea was to have a kind of little a policeman in the region to defend their interests. The creation of Israel was a crime against the Palestinian people, because it took away their homeland, in many cases literally thrown, you know, they were thrown out of their houses, villages were bombed. They talk about terrorism. Israel was created on the back of terrorism, but it was Jewish terrorism against the Palestinians. If you read the history books, you'll see several villages were attacked, pillaged, women were raped, houses burnt, and it was to encourage the others, and it led to the fleeing of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from the areas where the Jews were dominant, and created the permanent problem we have now of the refugees in the camps all around Israel, in Lebanon, in Jordan, and other areas. And it led to several wars. We had the first war, obviously, where Israel not only was given more land than would have been proportional to the population they had in Palestine, but they weren't happy with that. They took even more. They went to war, and they carved out more territory, and then that was recognized as Israel. And the West Bank was integrated into Jordan, and Gaza was connected more to Egypt. But the idea always had been that there would be some kind of homeland for the Palestinians. But it led to the 67 war, then the war in 73. It spilled over into the occupation of Lebanon, war against Syria, where they took the Golan Heights, which they still hold today. And most recently, the war last year, where Israel attempted to invade Lebanon and failed. So we've had a homeless people, the Palestinians now, for 60 years. The Arab regimes have exploited this question demagogically. The poor Palestinians, and they blame every evil in society on the Jews, even as far away as Morocco, which is one hell of a distance from Israel. But they conveniently use Israel as a scapegoat for all the ills of the system, while at the same time actually cozying up to imperialism. Morocco is not exactly an anti-imperialist regime. Egypt is completely in the pockets of U.S. imperialism. The same is the case with Jordan, Saudi Arabia, etc. But they all talk about the poor Palestinians, but actually never lift a finger for them. For example, there was the famous Black September, when there was the conflict in actually it was the Palestinians against the Jordanian army in 1970, where the Jordanians massacred 20,000 Palestinians. That's why it's called Black September. Nobody intervened to help. In actual fact, the Jordanian regime, which is supposed to be an Arab regime and the Palestinians are Arabs, actually massacred the Palestinians. The reason being, the majority of the population in Jordan is actually Palestinian, and the Palestinians were being radicalized, and it was crushing that movement. Now, what is the solution? Because I'm having to be schematic on this question, but can this question be solved under capitalism? We say it can't be solved under capitalism, because the very existence of a capitalist Israel means a Zionist Israel, which an expansionist Israel, and that cannot tolerate an independent Palestinian state next door, because for the Palestinians, gaining a homeland is not simply having a border within which they can say, this is our home. What they want is a solution to all the problems they've got: housing, clean water, education, etc. And capitalism can't give that to the Palestinians. Therefore, it would be a radicalized situation, and in permanent conflict with Israel. So the Israelis are not going to allow any kind of genuine, independent Palestinian state to come into existence. It can only be solved on a socialist basis. Now, there are some groups, Stalinist groups and that, the two-stage theory, that say, first solve the national question. Some of them are crazy. Some of them say, kick the Jews out, and that's the solution. And by the way, on that, our position is that in 1948, it was a criminal thing they did, but today, 60 years later, there is a people now living in Israel. And as Marxists, we have to recognize that there is an Israeli nation that has come into existence. It's been created artificially, but now it exists. The people are born there. They live there. This is their home. So the question is, how do we solve the problem, respecting the rights both of the Israeli people and the Palestinian people? And we say it's only possible on a socialist basis, i.e., an economic system which allows the resources to be used to guarantee clean water to everybody, housing to everybody. Because at the end, as Lenin said, the national question is a question of bread. It's a question of economic question of real living conditions. And the position we've developed is we are for one state within which the Palestinians have a right to live, with two autonomous regions. You have federal states where you have regional autonomies, where you'd have education in Hebrew, education in Arabic, the respect for the Jewish religion, respect for the Islamic religion, etc., where both peoples would have a homeland, two autonomous regions within a federal state, with a federal capital in Jerusalem, but with the right to free movement. Of course, it wouldn't be a border which would block people, but at least guarantee both peoples an area which they can feel they're not threatened. Because after all these decades of conflict, the two peoples feel threatened by each other, obviously. Now, over a period of development of the economy, gradually this national question would recede. Because if you look at other situations, for example, Yugoslavia. In the Second World War, you had terrible killing between Serbs and Croats on both sides, nationalists on both sides, and butchery on both sides. After the war, the partisan movement, which united Serbs and Croats and Macedonians and Slovenians, etc., in the struggle against the Nazi occupation, although it was a deformed worker state with a lot of distortions, it was, if you think about it, it was one state, the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, with autonomous republics within it, Slovenia, Serbia, Croatia, Macedonia, etc., and Bosnia and Herzegovina, within which you even had other autonomous regions like Vojvodina in Serbia, which is the Hungarian minority, and Kosovo in the south, which is the Albanian minority. And on the basis of the economic development of Yugoslavia over about 20 years, if you look at it, the national question was solved, at least for a period, on the basis that the economy was developing. If you went to Sarajevo, it became a cosmopolitan town where you had Croats, Serbs, Bosnians, etc., living together, mixing together. And then it all broke down when the economic crisis hit Yugoslavia in the 80s. There was a massive, there was like 2,000% inflation, the collapse of the economy, 1 million employed, and the crisis of the Stalinist regime. That's what brought the national question back to the surface with the terrible killings. But I'm using the example to show you that it is possible to solve these national problems in this way. The limits of Stalinism, of course, obviously the development of the bureaucracy, etc., that's a different question, which had its limits. But it gives you a glimpse of what would be possible under a genuine socialist regime, where the economy and the resources are genuinely used to create jobs, housing, education for all. Because that's, at the end of the day, what it really is about. The national question behind it has real material interests. Now, the PLO, which was actually set up in the early 60s and backed by the Arab bourgeoisies as a kind of as a channel to control, really, the Palestinian movement, adopted a policy which was one: destroy Israel and expel the Jews, and combined with individual terrorism, bombing campaigns, kidnappings, etc., etc. It achieved absolutely nothing. It didn't bring the Palestinian people one inch, 1 millimeter nearer to achieving a homeland. In actual fact, it moved them further away. Every bomb, every hijacking of a plane, etc., every threat against Israel strengthened the Zionist state. It didn't weaken it, because it strengthened the conviction of the Israeli people that we have to support this state. It's the only thing defending us against the Arabs who want to destroy us. And it was in the constitution of the PLO, written in the late 60s, that they only recognized as citizens of Palestine those Jews that were descended from those people who were born there before the partition, and therefore all those Jews that come afterwards would be thrown out. That's not exactly a way of convincing or winning over the Jewish workers to your cause. It actually pushes them to the right. We always explained throughout the last 60 years that the solution has to be a class solution. You have to break down Israeli society along class lines, separate the working class from the ruling class. And unless you do that, you can bomb and bomb and bomb, and you will never destroy Israel. Because it's a powerful capitalist regime. If it has the backing of its own population, combined with one of the most powerful armies in the world, and the backing of US imperialism, if Israel should ever be threatened with destruction, you can be guaranteed that America will be there with its ships and even with its army. It will not allow Israel to be destroyed because it's its main ally. Therefore, the road has to be a class one. And we always explained, we're not against revolutionary wars, but the leadership of the Palestinians should be aiming their propaganda at the working class of Israel, not directing its bombs in supermarkets or buses and killing Israeli schoolchildren. It's one thing to fight the Israeli army that's occupying was occupying Gaza and is still occupying large parts of the West Bank. That's a military conflict. Another thing is to go and carry out acts of individual terrorism against the Israeli civilians, barbaric methods, which only serve to strengthen reaction. But it has to be directed at the working class. Now, Israel was a country where 30 years ago you had full employment and a very high standard of living compared to the rest of the Arab world, the rest of the Middle East. Now, it's a completely polarized society. Unemployment is over 10% in Israel. There are extremely poor people. There are people who go to the supermarket, who go to the markets and pick the rotten fruit and vegetables at the end of the day to survive. The state is carrying out cuts in pensions, cuts in healthcare, cuts in education. The welfare state that Israel had in the past, which they were proud of, is gradually being destroyed. It's the same policy as everywhere else. In education, there are attacks. And this is provoking a movement. There was an article in April, which the communists can read on the website, about the movement of the students demanding the right to education. These are Jewish students demonstrating against increase in university tuition fees. And it was quite a powerful movement. And these are Jewish students fighting who? They're not fighting the Palestinians here. They're fighting the Israeli government. We've had general strikes in Israel. We've had dock worker strikes. We've had airport worker strikes. We've had government worker strikes, teacher strikes. Who are they striking against? Their own government. This is supposed to be the promised land that God promised Abraham. On that basis, it belongs to them, you know. On that basis, most of you should go to Germany and live, because you probably mostly descended from Saxons who came here 1,500 years ago, and therefore have no right to live here, and this should be given back to the Welsh. You actually have more rights to it than the Jews have to Palestine, because they lived there 2,000 years ago. If we use that, it's completely crazy logic, you know, it's also a reactionary position. I don't know why I've gone down that road. Yes, this is supposed to be the haven for the Jews, the safe homeland that God gave them, where they would be safe and nobody would ever, you know, no Holocaust, no anti-Jewish pogroms and all the rest of it. And yet they've been in constant war. They're losing soldiers all the time. They're being killed all the time. Under threat all the time. And on top of that, you have a government which is made up of Jews, that is cutting pensions of Jews, increasing tuition fees for Jews, sacking Jewish workers, etc., etc. So it's a class society like any other society, and therefore it can be broken down along class lines if you apply the correct policies. And an indication of this came in 1987 when you had the Intifada, which was a mass movement. It wasn't individual terrorism, the odd bomb here or there. It was the whole of the Palestinian people that rose up. Because of the terrible conditions in which they... Because although I said, you know, that the bourgeois in Israel attack their own workers, the standard of living is between one area and another is incomparable. If you look at the settlers, the settlements, you will see a village which has all the most modern amenities, clean water, electricity, etc., etc., etc. Next to it, you'll see a village which has dirty water. You can actually see in photographs a pipe which takes the clean water next to a ditch which the Palestinians have to make do with. The completely opposite conditions right next to each other. that creates enormous resentment and conflict. And on top of that, you have the people in the camps, the army, which is ever present. In 1987, it erupted in a mass movement, the Intifada, which is a kind of an insurrectionary movement. And this sent a message into Israeli society, which none of the individual terrorist acts had ever achieved. It sent a message to the Israeli people that the Palestinians don't want you here, and they have very urgent and pressing problems to solve. And it stirred the people in Israel. It had an effect, and particularly even on the army. It had a demoralizing effect on the army because they could see that the mass of people were against them. Another indication of the radicalized mood in Israel was in the early 80s, after the occupation of Lebanon, because Israel went into Lebanon to smash the Palestinian camps there, which were being used to attack Israel. Now, there was a demonstration of 400,000 people in Tel Aviv, I think it was in 1982, against the occupation of Lebanon for the withdrawal of the troops. Now consider this, this is a country of about 6 million people. 400,000 on a demonstration is like 4 million, 5 million demonstrating in London. A very powerful message was being sent, and it showed that you can cut across this national bloc in Israel. And we need to break it down along class lines. That's the policy that we have to adopt. And that's what we've always said to the Palestinians that we've ever met in terms of the policies they should be adopting. By the way, on this question, there's something that's come up recently, this boycott. The socialist worker, the SWP, and other people have been promoting a boycott of Israel in the unions. It came up in Norwich University, etc., etc. There's an article on our website written by the Israeli Communist which explains why that is wrong. It's not going to affect Israeli society. In actual fact, if you notice, there's a massive counter lobby against it. And in Norwich, they very easily can tear the idea apart. What they said was, well, if you're going to boycott Israel because it's oppressing the Palestinians, why aren't you launching a boycott of America? Because it's the war in Iraq. And why aren't you... They were saying we should boycott Israeli universities because they collaborate with the oppression of the Palestinians. And this guy, Zionist, says, well, why don't we boycott British universities because you've got troops in Iraq? They got no answer to that. And they can't give an answer to it. Our position is that we're not against the whole of Israel, we're against the Zionist ruling class of Israel. The workers and students of Israel are not our enemies. And in fact, if the Norwich Commons will remember that, I remember there was that guy there, who that old guy with the little skull cap there, he said he'd come along to check there wasn't any anti-Semitism in the meeting. And he said he was pleasantly pleased to find there wasn't any. And I could see when I was speaking that he looked very perplexed because he couldn't understand where I was coming from. Because on the one hand, I wasn't attacking Israel as such. I was attacking Zionism. And I was raising, you know, what's happening to the Jews. And they were a bit bewildered because all they're used to is if you're anti-Israel, you're anti the whole of Israel. One block. I've actually seen articles that say, the workers of Israel are just one mass of reactionaries, they support the Zionists, that's it. On that basis, you haven't really got a solution to the problem. You cannot solve the problem, because you cannot destroy Israel as it exists through war and terrorism. You can only destroy it through the class struggle. Not destroy it as an entity for the Jews, but as a bourgeois state, as a Zionist state which oppresses the Palestinians. That is really the only real answer. And our boycott, if any, would be a workers' boycott. We would promote the boycotting of sending, for instance, arms to Israel. That kind of way, a class approach. I heard the argument that they raised that we should boycott Israel to bring down the Zionist regime, as we did with the South Africa. And even in Norwich, I have to point out that it wasn't the boycott that brought down the South African regime. It was the mass movement of millions of South African workers, the creation of COSATU with a million members, etc., etc., etc. It was the class struggle that brought down the apartheid regime, not a few middle-class people in London supermarkets saying, I'm not buying that, it's from South Africa. It doesn't have any effect in reality. And it actually can be used against you as an argument.